The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
No idea that was the bio that would be used. Sounds like somebody else. Well, I'm delighted to be able to be here in this makeshift alternative space with Mahapajapati as our guiding force. We've got our backs and our fronts here, so I think that's great. Well, today, of course, the big news is the eclipse, right? It's dark in the middle of the day. It was a time of total eclipse for some parts of North America. We didn't quite get the totality here, but it's kind of interesting to watch the moon temporarily blot out the sun. So this is this idea of the earth and the sun and the moon. This is our scientific explanation for the phenomenon, which is the accepted way of understanding it in our culture. And this understanding, this view of what's going on, has generated a lot of activity. I know a lot of people who flew or drove to Oregon. A friend's husband decided to climb Half Dome in order to get a better view of it. There were herds of people, what they were called umbrophiles, following the totality along. And there was probably a small boost to the economy from the sale of those specialized glasses at 7-Eleven, right? So, and then there was people watching on their computers. And so, you know, consequently, many more people were able to see this eclipse than some other ones. So this is all just because of our understanding, the way we see what's going on. Other peoples and cultures have used very different interpretations over the eons. Eclipses are not new to human culture. They happen a lot, and we've been dealing with them a lot. So I looked up some of the other options. There's one that says a dragon is eating the moon, or the head of a beheaded god is doing this, and that's why the sun reappears after it passes through the open neck. People also believe that there's something wrong with how we've behaved, and so it needs to be rectified. You know, the gods are angry that they're taking away our sun briefly. Or there's one story that says that the sun and the moon are brother and sister. And so when they come together in the sky, what are they doing? And so, you know, there's not supposed to be copulating like that. And so that creates a culturally acceptable way to have conversations about sex and incest. So it's interesting that often eclipses were seen in a somewhat negative light. And so the positive one that we experience now of being excited about it is quite out of the norm, actually. So we see that our perspective on something matters. It affects our whole body and all of our mind states. Getting excited and going somewhere in order to see an eclipse is completely different behavior than cowering or sacrificing animals, which has also happened. So, you know, you can wonder also what stories people are going to add to the mix in the future. Might they be even yet more different than what we've heard so far? It's not so much that we need to have the right story, because all stories have limitations in the end. But the question really is whether the story we're telling is useful for our aim. And if our aim is to end suffering or stress or dukkha, are our perspectives and our actions helping that aim? So on the theme of the eclipse, here is an image that's used for the mind in the texts. Luminous is the mind, and it is defiled by visiting defilements. Luminous is the mind, and it is freed from visiting defilements. So I'm sorry about the word defilements. Some people react to that. It's meant to represent the constellation of mind states around greed, hatred, and delusion, which are things that we wouldn't want to have in our mind. I would include in that both temporary emotions like anger or sadness, and also things that last longer, like biases or stories about people, including about ourselves. And maybe instead of defiled, we could say dimmed, or occasionally even eclipsed, right? So this perspective, though, is interesting because it says that the mind is luminous, but it has these visitors. Another translation calls them incoming defilements. And so it suggests that they aren't inherently part of the mind. The mind can be freed from these things. It's not inherently problematic. It just has some temporary problems. So it's kind of hopeful in a sense. So we might ask then, how do we move from having these visitors to not having them? So this is basically the movement away from suffering, or stress, or struggle, or unsatisfactoriness, other words for the same thing, which is the movement toward peace. I note, though, that the Buddha more often talked in terms of letting go of harmful states. Kind of in line with this image of luminosity that gets dimmed, he tended to talk about freedom in terms of absence. So when various things are absent, that is when the mind becomes free. So I'm going to choose to talk more from the perspective of leading away from suffering, leading away from difficult mind states. And as I thought about that phrase, I realized that we tend to use it a lot in Buddhist practice, almost glibly. All the time we say we should do things that lead away from suffering, and we should not do things that lead towards suffering, because this is, after all, the fundamental discernment that we need to have in order to begin practice. But I began to reflect on what this really means. We tend to assume that we would just know what is leading away from suffering. But maybe we don't. Maybe it's worth considering that a little bit more. We may carry some assumptions about leading away from suffering. And most powerfully, we might believe that this means getting rid of the unpleasant. It's quite natural and easy to think that that would be the same thing. And it's true that moving away from suffering, definitely a lot of it is about relieving pain of various kinds. But it's not quite identical to getting rid of the unpleasant. What about situations that we can't actually change, such as pain during a disease or the reality of aging? I had chronic pain for a number of years, and I generated quite a bit of dukkha in seeking ways to make it go away. I thought if I couldn't do that, then I was guaranteed to have to keep suffering. It was a big revelation that suffering can end without the pain ending. So the movement away from suffering might not be the same as the elimination of the unpleasant. And then the flip side, what about the fact that there are some things that are helpful for the path that do indeed bring some temporary pain? Like, for example, reflecting on how we made a mistake, if we hurt somebody or just lost mindfulness. So we reflect on that, we feel genuine remorse, and then maybe being able to go apologize if that's what's needed, and to rectify our behavior. So that's not always very pleasant in the moment to do that, but that kind of self-understanding and corrective action surely leads away from suffering in the long run. And then somewhat related, either consciously or unconsciously, to talk about another assumption we have about leading away from suffering, we may think that leading away is about trying to get the result that we want. So I'm now thinking about daily life situations or including action in the world. we decide ahead of time that a certain result means that the suffering is gone, and then we judge efforts to lead away by whether or not they're going toward our desired outcome. Again, it's somewhat natural, but it actually narrows the field of possibility to decide in advance what non-suffering looks like and then have to go in that direction. I'll give kind of a simple, benign example. There was a case where some neighborhood kids were leaving a gate open, and it was a pretty big, wide wooden gate. And it, so it took time to swing the gate all the way open and then close it and latch it. And when you're playing as a kid, you don't have time for that kind of thing when you're running through the neighborhood. But the man with the gate wanted them to keep it closed because otherwise the dog would get out. And so it became kind of an issue. He was a little crotchety old guy, of being responsible. You know, come on, you kids are not responsible. You need to close this gate because of blah, blah, blah. And it was all explained to them. But that really only made the kids less inclined to comply, right? So then everybody's suffering, and everybody has each side has an idea of what the outcome should be so that there's no more suffering. But then the man got a brilliant idea, and he installed a plastic ladder on one side of the gate and a plastic slide on the other side of the gate, affixed to the top so the gate could still swing open and closed. But then the kids didn't have to open and close the gate, right? It was fun for them to go up the ladder and down the slide. So problem solved. But more seriously, we may carry ideas for how a certain political situation should be resolved. And maybe it's not feasible. Maybe we need to open for some more creative way instead of our idea of what the non-suffering is going to look like. Or there may just have to be equanimity, like in the case of unavoidable pain sometimes. It's not just about getting rid of all the unpleasant feelings. So if our kind of natural but not always accurate assumptions about how to lead away from suffering are a little questionable sometimes, what would be more accurate indicators that we are actually moving away from suffering in the sense that the Buddha was talking about? So with a little bit of risk, I'll read what he actually says about this, because he does give a clear general answer, but then we'll get more specific. So his general answer is, there are things such that when a person attends to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire arises, and the arisen taint of sensual desire increases. And the same for the taint of wanting to be something and the taint of ignorance. So there are things that when we attend to them, if these problems are not present, they come, and if they're already present, they increase. He says, these are the things that are unfit for attention. And then there are things such that when a person attends to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire does not arise in him, and the arisen taint already there is abandoned, and so forth. So these are the things that are fit for attention. So basically we notice in the moment whether what we're doing is tending to increase the difficult mind states we already have, or even bring in new ones, or is it tending to decrease the existing ones and prevent new ones? So this is about whether our luminosity is being dimmed by visiting difficult mind states. So you can hear that and say, well, that sounds quite logical, but what would be some practical examples of that? So I want to draw out then some specific examples of how to do things that lead away from suffering. One clue is that we are more connected to the present with less interference from the past or the future. So there's this verse. Let not a person revive the past or on the future build her hopes. For the past has been left behind, and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let her see each presently arisen state. Let her know that, and be sure of it, etc. So in general, we're moving toward a simpler presence of just knowing what's here and not bringing in a lot of baggage from the past or a lot of projections about the future. And when there are the problematic kind of mind states present, this kind of simplification tends to starve them or at least stop them from growing. And then secondly, a great way to move away from suffering is to have more wholeness and integration in our being, so head, heart, body, mind, connected together. We tend to, depending on the kind of mind that we have, we tend to either fall into an intellectual stance or fall into an emotional reaction, kind of depending on our type. And it's actually helpful to include all of this in our awareness, to not exclusively go to one part of our being. Awareness is greater than both intellect and emotion, so it can hold all of that. And in particular, it's very important to stay in the body, you know, to stay with that, as well as with our open heart. As an example, I was once in a chaplaincy situation. I was volunteering at the hospital, talking with someone where the situation in the room was quite tragic. I won't give the whole story, but I was talking to the wife. The husband was the patient, and he was there because there had been a mistake in treating something that he had, and it got a lot worse, and he wound up in a bad situation. And because of that, they didn't have a lot of spare money, and he wasn't working, and so they were going to be evicted. And their daughter was graduating from high school, but they didn't have enough money to really give her a gift or anything. And it was just, the more she told about what was going on, which I had asked to learn, I just felt my heart breaking listening to all of this. And I couldn't just escape from the situation. So how could I stay present and, you know, reduce my increasing suffering in order to be able to support her? And what happened was I went straight into my body and I kept listening with an open heart, but I encouraged the energy to just run out of my feet. It was the only way that I could kind of process all of that coming in. And the earth was happy to accept that. And it kind of helped the compounding feelings of sadness for her situation from escalating. And when it was held in that kind of attention, then there was the opportunity for genuine compassion to be there. I had enough strength to feel closer to that. But without it, you know, we don't have the strength. It will fall into some kind of reaction. Another way to judge movement away from suffering is to have more bodily ease, even if it remains unpleasant. There's a difference between a tight or braced body and feeling ease, even if there's something difficult. Once we're connected to the body, it becomes possible to actually encourage ease. And that's actually a great practice, is to feel in a given situation, if you have enough extra mindfulness left over, where am I bracing? Am I leaning on something or pushing against something or holding my buttocks and back tight, you know, these kinds of things. Joan Halifax, who's a wonderful Zen teacher and caregiver, talks about entering another person's suffering with strong back, soft front, which I like a lot. This is actually the most easeful posture for the body, is to have, to be erect in a non-rigid way, and with an open in the heart and belly. It's actually more easeful than either being rigid, obviously, but also than being completely collapsed. More easeful to have that combination of some strength, but also softness and flexibility. And then getting to the more advanced practices, we can be aware of the story that we're telling in a given situation, and then be able to modify or drop that story as needed. I told a whole bunch of possible stories at the beginning about what we might tell about an eclipse. That's a pretty emotionally neutral topic, at least for us now. It wasn't back then. But imagine something that's much more charged. We definitely have a story about that. Can we even see what that is and try to be open to other options? So right here from 2,600 years ago, see the world, conceiving not self to be self, entrenched in name and form. They conceive that this is true. In whatever terms they conceive it, it turns into something other than that. So the Buddha already knew that we have a tendency to see our perspective as what's true. And then he points out, this is often summarized in the phrase, however we conceive, it is ever different than that. Or, more modern, from the Dalai Lama, the way in which things and events unfold does not always coincide with our expectations. Indeed, this fact of life, that there is often a gap between the way in which we perceive phenomena and the reality of a given situation, is the source of much unhappiness. This is especially true when we make judgments on the basis of partial understanding, which turns out not to be fully justified. Anybody ever done that? No. Yeah. So leading away from suffering can be about expanding our perspective and simply remembering that we don't know. We don't know everything. And then awareness itself is actually quite easeful. We can move away from suffering by switching to a stance that's more with the awareness than with the phenomena. We're getting to the more advanced practices. Actually, this is quite important. It's possible, with all the things I've described up to now, that we might be suppressing the unwholesome mind state that is blocking the luminosity. When we want that state to decrease, or we want wholesome states to increase, it's very easy to slip down into the favoring of one of some states by suppressing other ones. Yeah, it's kind of natural that we'll do that at first when mindfulness is not too strong, but eventually we can move toward a mode of practice where all the states of mind are received just as they are, in awareness. That's the key, is that they're received in awareness fully as they are, and they're purified actually by the act of the strong attention itself. That's all that's needed. From Zen Master Hong Zi, the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. So this is like the eclipse from the perspective of the sun. To the sun, there is no eclipse. The moon and the earth are tiny specks of dust far away from the sun. I don't think it noticed at all that there was an eclipse today. Right? And so, you know, it certainly wouldn't notice a couple specks of dust passing in front of each other. It just keeps warming them both equally in line with the laws of physics. So it's one of the amazing things about practice that there is no fundamental need to decide that greed is bad and generosity is good, and then actively work with that. This is a useful way to work at times, but it's not the only way. Amazingly, mindfulness itself, awareness itself, can do this work. And eventually we have that powerful shining of the sun that purifies everything. Sometimes switching perspectives means switching from the earth to the sun. So I want to tell a story that maybe brings together some of these. Or maybe I just want to tell it, and so you'll have to figure out the connection. I don't know, but it's a good story. It's from the Shangpa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. And it starts with a married woman who has a husband and three sons, and they live together. And they've fallen on hard times, though, and the work isn't coming in for the men, and they're kind of running out of money, and they get down to having just one measure of rice left. That's all they have in the whole household. So the husband and the sons say, well, surely we can do something about this, and they head off in the four cardinal directions to look for work. And, of course, the woman is left at home. And so she, while she's there, a savana comes by, a wandering recluse, devoted, who's devoted his life to spiritual practice, wandering without a home, and he comes by and begs for food. And the woman is, of course, moved by this and is confident that her husband and sons will be successful, so she gives him the rice. And off he goes. And then in the evening, the men come home, and they have not been successful, and they didn't find any work. And so they say, well, we didn't do it today, so let's have the rice. And she says, oh, I gave it away to a wandering mendicant. And they get angry with her and throw her out. So she finds herself a beggar and wanders off and eventually manages to survive, but wanders into another country or nearby area after a while. And one day she gets a donation that's pretty good. She gets a fair amount of barley and rice and decides to make beer out of it. And so she makes the beer and she goes and sells it in the marketplace and makes enough money on it that she can buy more materials and continues to offer beer. It's pretty good beer, actually. People come and they pay for it. And so she learns that she's capable of that, and she starts a business in the marketplace and goes pretty well for a while. And one day, a very elegantly dressed woman shows up in this marketplace and asks for a measure of beer. And she says, well, okay, but is that for you, really? And she says, no, 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 it's for my teacher. I have a powerful spiritual teacher. And so the woman says, well, in that case, just take it. No need to pay. And so she says, well, thank you, and takes it off. And this continues for a while. The elegantly dressed woman comes every day, and every day she says, oh, just take it. And off it goes. And meanwhile, the spiritual master is really enjoying this beer. It is really very good beer. And so he, one day he says to the elegant lady, isn't this kind of expensive? Because this is really good. And she says, oh, no, well, the woman in the marketplace who makes and sells it just gives it because she knows that you're a spiritual teacher. And he says, well, we've got to do something for her. Bring her here. And so the elegant lady goes back and, you know, picks up the woman and says, come on, my teacher wants to meet you. And so she shows up. And it turns out that from all of her generosity and goodness, she was really ripe for spiritual teachings. And the master sees this immediately and gives her pointing out instructions. And she awakens and becomes a great spiritual teacher herself. She became the teacher called Sukhasiddhi, and, you know, ends up helping many other people overcome their suffering. So it's an interesting story in and of itself, and we can be inspired by the sort of archetypal nature of it. But I'll offer also a little bit of an interpretation that's been applied to this story, which is that you start out with a situation that's basically conventional. Marriage, family, working for money, living in a household. And that conventional system begins to break down. It's not working. It's not sustaining itself. Something isn't working. And when that happens, what the system does is it goes out and tries to do more of the same. The husband and sons go off and try to find more work. Let's remake what we've got. Let's try to keep this going. And in the meantime, when you're at that point of breakdown, often there's a knock on the door. The spiritual comes knocking on the door, right? And you have the option. You can feed it or not. And she fed it. And now that resulted in the system throwing her out completely. She made her choice, and the conventional was not going to have that. But she went out and didn't lose heart and did what she could. Temporarily, it was harder for her, for sure. But she discovered resources she never knew she had. She discovered she could make great beer. I mean, that's an interesting discovery. And then eventually, another spiritual opportunity came in this woman, and she fed it again. She said, just take it. She again donated, take the beer. She never had a sense of, I'm on a great spiritual path, climbing the mountain, or I'm looking for a teacher who's going to help me get out of my terrible situation. She just responded with her heart again and again to the opportunities that presented themselves in her regular, normal, not very exceptional looking life. And then it bears great fruit when the time is right. So I think there's a nice role here for faith in this process of clearing the obstacles from our sun, continuing to nourish what is most meaningful, even if we can't see the larger arc of what's going on. So when there's an eclipse, we just keep doing the practice with faith that the sun will return. The point is peace, of course. And there can be some subtle non-peace in the way we approach the Dharma sometimes when we don't understand. So we can, for example, get caught up in making an effort in our practice, in continually adjusting and making ourselves the agent of our progress. I'm going to get those obstacles out of the way. It's a self-improvement project that I am orchestrating. That's one way that we can go. Of course, we can also get caught up in concepts of nibbana or transcendence, kind of dismissing worldly concerns. So I don't need to pay attention to all this humdrum kind of stuff because I'm transcending all of that. In my experience, at least, all kinds of mind states cycle through. Sometimes we do have transcendent experiences, and sometimes we're just in the daily grind. And sometimes we find a balance between them that allows the path to unfold by itself. So peace is actually about living with all of these when they come. Just continually choosing to move in the way that leads away from suffering, truly away from suffering. So this is a poem called Peace. And there, on the to-do list, somewhere beneath post office and above pay the bills, is a single word not yet crossed out. Peace. You've written it in ink, as if to offer it permanence, an urgency that can't be erased. Every day you look at it, wondering if this is the day that goodwill will come as easily as changing the burned-out light bulbs or taking the garbage out. You almost stop believing you will ever cross it off. After a while, it might seem just like any other thing you write on your list and then ignore, like dust beneath the piano or organize the garage. But then the news will shake you, will render your duties small, and you'll write it in at the top of the list in all caps, underlined in blue. And though you still don't know what to do, you know that it comes first, and that tomorrow, no matter how long the list, you'll write it at the top again. Thank you. We have a few minutes.